So the topic of today's talk is going to be about sex, relationships, and dharma. I think what I'd like to do is start out with the textual things on the topic, what there is, and then talk about, I guess, my own experience of how these things meld together. The Buddha, the historical Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, had a pretty low opinion of, at least it seems from the text, had a pretty low opinion of these sorts of things. So you probably heard from my previous talks, me talking about what the Buddha called his son. The Buddha named his son Rahula, which means fetter, or something that chains you. His view of family life was rather dismal. Honestly, mine at the moment is pretty comparable. And the monks were prohibited from having sex. The rules that the monks lived by are in a book called the Vinaya. It's the Code of Rules. And the monks, I think to this day, recite the Padimokkha. The Padimokkha is, I think, not all the rules, but it's some subset of the rules. And when you get together, you recite these rules. The reason that monks started reciting the Padimokkha was because a monk did have sex. When the order started out, there were no rules. And the way a rule got made is every time somebody did something stupid, the Buddha would make a rule that you couldn't do this stupid thing again in the future. So the Vinaya is a little bit entertaining because it's the story of all the stupid things that people did that led to rules about how you shouldn't do these stupid things anymore. But it seems like among the worst stupid things you could do was there was a monk who had been married and left his family to be a monk. And he went back to visit his parents, and they were trying to convince him to stop being a monk. But he said no. And they said, well, why don't you at least go hang out with your wife? And he says, okay. And he does, and they have sex twice, and she becomes pregnant. And the Buddha really chews the monk out. He calls him foolish. There's one of the best lists in all of the Pali Canon, the list of places it would be better to put your penis than a woman. It includes a pit of flaming coals and the mouth of a viper. I had my own suggestion, but the Buddha didn't. the Buddha didn't come up with the idea that I came up with to avoid this conundrum. But so as far as why the Buddha doesn't want the monks to have sex, probably a large part of this was cultural. That the Buddha created a community of beggars. The monks didn't go to work, and they would go into town every day begging for food. And if you're begging for food and then sleeping with the townswomen, you might be less likely to get the food. Probably more importantly, if you're getting married and having babies, there's a lot more mouths to feed. There's a lot more work to do. And it's not as good for the order. And none of us on the call right now have children. But if you talk to people who do have children, there's a lot less time for meditation when you have children. It's an awfully large responsibility. So the Buddha seemed pretty down on sex for at least for the monastics. But it was probably largely for cultural reasons. This idea of affiliation, of becoming intimate with somebody, whether it's sexual or not, the Buddha in the teachings comes down pretty strongly, but in both directions. So there's a story where somebody comes to the Buddha and asks about somebody that she's in love with, and the Buddha says, "Dear ones who endear themselves bring suffering, bring pain." And this woman thinks this is the stupidest thing she ever heard, and she storms off and she finds a bunch of people playing cards, and she tells them, "Can you believe this stupid thing that the Buddha said?" And it makes it all the way back up to the queen, and the queen then understands it. And the queen says to the king, who also thinks it was a stupid thing, he says, "Well, you love me, right?" "Well, okay, yes." "Suppose there was some change or some alteration that came over me. Wouldn't that change your life?" And he says, "Yes." And she goes through a list of, "Well, what about your daughter? And what about such and such?" And so there's certainly this theme that the more attached you are to people, the more intimate you are with people, the more that you're setting yourself up for suffering. There's some place where he says, you know, somebody with two close friends has two problems. Somebody with one close friend has one problem. Somebody with no close friends has no problems. There's also this other angle of close relationships where there's a sutra called Half of the Holy Life, where Ananda, the Buddha's chief attendant, says to the Buddha, isn't it wonderful that good friends and admirable companions are half of the holy life? And the Buddha says, do not say this, Ananda, do not say this. No noble companions, admirable friends, this is the whole of the holy life. Somebody with noble friends and admirable companions will be sure to develop the Eightfold Path. We see this too in the three jewels in Buddhism, of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So the Buddha is the example that it really is possible to become enlightened because somebody who is a person just like you became enlightened. The Dharma is the path, it's how you do it, and the Sangha is the group of people that you're doing it with. So we see, as far as the monastics, as far as the Buddha's view, as far as the Buddha's view on intimate relationships, that it's fairly split, kind of polarized. And to me, this makes sense. You know, both of these are true. And I think that the balance lies somewhere in the middle. As far as how sex actually relates to the path, one thing that's very useful about sex is it's one of the strongest cravings. And the second noble truth is that tana, often translated as craving, is the root of all of your suffering. And anything that will allow you to see deeply into tana is helpful. If you go on retreat and find that you don't get really horny and distracted at some point, you're a very abnormal person. So our normal thing that we do when we get horny is we see if we can find somebody who will have sex with us. And Lenson was talking earlier in the Sangha tonight about having found this new method of existence where the cravings arise and you deliberately don't follow them. This is a really, really good thing to do, to watch how much you feel like sex is going to make you happy, like sex is going to change your life, like sex is even going to diminish the drive for sex, and you find that it doesn't. But this delusion comes up over and over and over. You get this drive, and you know, meditation has largely cured me of this, but for most of my post-virginity life, I could not have sex for about 2 or 3 months, and then it was all I could think about. It would subsume my mind, and I would decide that if I just had sex with somebody, it would go away. And sure enough, it largely didn't, but this delusion would keep persisting of happiness in the act. This is great if you can actually watch how the delusion is formed, and you can see through it, you know? I'll feel better if I've had sex. Well, how many times have you had sex? An awful lot. Do you feel better? No. So trying to decouple the drive for sex from having sex is an awfully helpful thing to do. Also trying to see the consequences of having sex when there's not somebody around it's a good idea to have sex with. I imagine this is something we've all experimented with because you'd very much like to have sex and there's a person and they're consenting and really your whole threshold for attraction right now is consenting and here they are, they've consented and everything is copacetic. and it turns out not to have been such a very good idea that you've now become involved with somebody. It would have been a better idea not to get involved with. This is another sense in which we can talk about karma, that when you simply act on the craving, you're setting yourself up for bad things to happen in the future, and when you sleep with the wrong people, you clearly set yourself up for bad things to happen in the future, also to cause quite a bit of suffering. to sleep with somebody if you're in a monogamous relationship, or even if you're not, but they've promised monogamy to somebody else. If they might be in love with you and you don't feel that way about them, or you're in love with them and you don't know if they feel that way about you, having sex with somebody if you're not clear that the two of you are on the same page, or if you don't know them well enough to even tell whether the two of you are on the same page, this can also be something that brings bad karma, that causes suffering, both for you and for them. Life is much nicer when you only decide to have sex when it's a good idea to have sex than when you have sex based on the clock. Well, it's been about 3 months, and that's really about my limit, and it's time to find somebody who is, like, alive, over 18, and consenting. When you do have sex, or when you masturbate, there seems to be a tendency among just about everybody I've talked to drift into fantasy. And what I was finding on retreat is that the act of sex, or the act of masturbation, as far as I can tell, doesn't inherently have any karma attached to it. But that if you actually use it as a meditative practice, if you masturbate and focus on the sensations, it can actually feel incredible. Maybe it's lame for a Dharma teacher to publicly admit to masturbating on retreat, but I'm sure we all do it. I'll go ahead and record on the internet that I do too. Masturbating on retreat has been some of the best orgasms I've ever had, when I'm actually able to bring the attention physically. When you're able to do this with somebody else, you become really skilled at the actual act of sex, when you become this attuned to your own body and how it's relating to theirs. This tendency to drift off into fantasy, though, I found really does seem to be bad karma, really does seem to lead to suffering. That on this last retreat that I did, there was a particular person who kept popping into my mind, and when I left retreat, I was, like, really interested in getting together with him, and it wasn't in the cards. But all craving makes you relate to people in unskillful and inaccurate ways, you know? If you see me as a Dharma teacher, as somebody who knows the truth, who's going to give it to you, you're missing all sorts of aspects about me. You're missing the reality of me as soon as you put some craving, some need onto me. And unfortunately, probably all human interactions have this component of putting the craving onto the other person. But I was finding that masturbating and thinking about other people was pulling me away from the physical sensations. It made it much less pleasant. And it created some awfully awkward, like, some foolishness between me and this other person who I had, like, you know, in my dreams been having sex with 3 times a week, and then in real life, like, we didn't know each other all that well. and this caused suffering. So at least from my own experience, I've found that sex and masturbation are kind of karmically neutral, but to use them as a meditation sort of makes you happier in general and makes the sex way, way better. It's a hard meditation, though. You know, when you first sit down to practice and you can't keep more than one breath in a row, the attention keeps drifting. I was finding with this, like, masturbation meditation, the same sort of thing, that, you know, my whole life I had gone into fantasy as soon as I would do this, and trying to come back from that and focus on my body was, you know, I was a brand new meditator in that respect. As far as relationships, you know, falling in love with somebody, well, let's talk about falling in love for a minute. I've had the benefit of recently having fallen super crazy in love with somebody for a few years, and then had the blessing of falling back out of love. So, you know, take it from me. I had a relationship one time. I don't. Not to necessarily bill myself as the expert on romance, but to just tell you how the Dharma seems to be related to it from my own practice of fairly successful Dharma and fairly unsuccessful romance. Love seems like the greatest of all delusions. Somebody told me a couple years ago, what you can't tell who you're with when you're with somebody. You don't find out who they are until after the fact. And I think this is a really common thing to see when people fall in love, that they really have absolutely no idea what the other person is like. You know, they've probably all been to weddings where we're thinking, like, what the hell are they doing? And shortly afterwards, our hypotheses are confirmed. This kind of falling in the crazy sort of rom-com love that the movies tell us is the true meaning of life. To me, this is kind of the ultimate delusion. It completely prevents you from seeing any of the negative aspects about your partner. And what happens when you fall out of love with somebody? Well, the delusion flips, and you go from a place where you could see nothing but positive things about your partner, or negative things you could maybe list, but you didn't really know them, to this flip, where you have only hatred, you can see only negative, only anger. And if you're lucky, this will come to some stasis at some point, where you can describe them in more kind of dynamic terms. So I really do think of rom-com level love as probably more a delusion than anything else. So what's the purpose of a relationship? Well, the normal purpose of a relationship is to satisfy craving, right? Satisfy craving for sex, satisfy craving for self-esteem, for love, to be made to feel a certain way, to be sometimes made to feel like you exist, you know? Just having somebody when you wake up in the morning to validate that you are in fact there. And often, once you get into these relationships, the point of the relationship becomes for the damn thing to continue. Quite a few years ago, I made the decision that every relationship I got into would have very early on a contract that this was a spiritual partnership. That the entire purpose of the relationship was to help each other advance on the path. And that any other benefits of the relationship were ancillary and secondary. And that if the relationship came to a point that we were no longer helping each other in this way, it should end. If this is what you say when you start dating somebody, you may find that you are usually single. And I have found this to be the case with myself. But I think it's better that way. Having somebody in your life all the time who wants to help you in this practice is fantastic, you know? Nothing is a better motivator for meditation than waking up every morning next to somebody who wants to meditate with you and you want to meditate with them, somebody you can bounce the Dharma off of. Most relationships have sort of attachment predicated within them, you know? And the first relationship I went into with this spiritual contract is with somebody who said he was into it, but I think really wasn't. And this idea that I was practicing non-attachment towards him, that I in a sense recognized his impermanence, that if he were to die, this wouldn't be all that shocking to me because I recognize that he's impermanent. Or that if our love fell apart, which it did, it wouldn't be all that shocking to me because I recognize that love was impermanent. This is a really hard thing for some people to take. This is a really hurtful thing for some people to take, you know? The idea that some change in them, some alteration in them wouldn't cause you all that much sorrow because you're expecting changes, alteration, and eventually physical destruction at some unknown time. This can be a very challenging thing for somebody else to understand. And so the result of this path, for better or worse, is that as far as I've seen, it really does narrow down the pool of people that you would be able to date. You know, the next thing that comes to my mind is the idea of jealousy. And I think for me in these kind of spiritual relationships, jealousy's been a great thing to work with. In that the normal reaction to jealousy is trying to control your partner, you know? It creeps me out when you talk to that other guy, when I see you flirting with him, even, you know, when I see you having sex with him, makes me jealous. Please don't do that anymore. I've been finding that jealousy is a great way to work with these attachments, with these needs. A great way to remember that suffering is internal. It's not caused by the other person's behavior, and that impetus to try to control the other person so that you don't have negative mind states. This is a pretty archetypal impulse, right? To try to control the world. To diminish your own negative mind states, even though it doesn't work. Whether Buddhists should be monogamous, polyamorous, into S&M, I really have no... I don't think it matters. There was a polyamorous monk in Berkeley last year who gave a talk on how... they call it compersion in the polyamory community. It's a happy, warm feeling you get from seeing your significant other being sexual or affectionate with another partner. He was talking about how this sentiment was similar to mudita, to sympathetic joy, which is one of the four Brahma Viharas in Buddhism. Personally, I've actually never promised monogamy simply because I like working with this. I don't think it matters whether you promise monogamy or whether you promise non-monogamy, but I do think that it matters, why you choose to promise monogamy or why you choose not to promise it or how you and your partner relate on those topics. That the choice doesn't matter, but having the choice be one of advancing the path rather than one of minimizing jealousy, I think is a good thing to do. I'm thinking maybe to conclude with, when you convert to Buddhism, you take five precepts. And these precepts are universal. Beyond the precepts, different traditions have different, you know, higher levels of conversion or higher levels of commitment you can take. And these are different by the tradition, but everybody agrees on these five precepts. And one of the precepts is the precept against sexual misconduct. And sexual misconduct has sort of obvious gross forms to it. So, you know, don't have sex with children, don't have sex with people who don't want to have sex with you, sort of obvious things that we don't really need to talk about. These more subtle levels of sexual misconduct, I think, is probably more so what the Buddha was talking about when he laid this out. So the Buddha was opposed to sex for monastics, but he wasn't opposed to sex for lay people. He just had them take a vow to have sex in a way that brought good karma. All of the precepts come from the notion that we have to interact with the world, and that interacting with the world necessarily involves creating suffering. There's no way you can eat without killing, even if you're a vegan. The amount of things that are killed to plant all the soybeans it takes to make all the tofu in the world is a massive amount of destruction. The idea of right livelihood is you need money to survive, and if you're getting money, that means somebody else isn't getting the money. That interaction with the world necessarily involves suffering. But the precepts can be this lifelong practice to create progressively less suffering as time goes on. And this is the way that I see sexual misconduct, that we can ignore the obvious sorts of, you know, illegal sexual misconduct. But I think that you can use a relationship to see... that you can use sex in general to see what... how do I mean to say this? The more that you're in a relationship, the better you can get at being in a relationship. And this is something that really can spread outwards. So, there's one view that having a particular significant other is actually an obstruction to universal love. And I've heard the Dalai Lama say this, I've heard Christian speakers say this, that if you love only one person, you love them better than everybody else, you've singled them out, and this is an obstacle to universal love. There's this flip side, which is finding somebody who you can really constantly deepen your love for, who you can learn to treat better and better and better throughout the course of years or decades or throughout the course of your life. This is one of, I think, the greatest practices you could possibly do. And from my last relationship, where I was in rom-com love for, you know, the first time at that crazy level that I thought didn't really exist, it set the bar a lot higher. You know, I didn't know you could love anybody that much. And now I realize that you could probably love everybody that much. You could even think that as special as your partner is to you, that person you just walked by on the street might be just that special to somebody else. So I was finding that I was able to use this relationship to deepen my sense of love and connection to everybody, and also to practice. To practice how to love people better, and practice how to get what I need from them progressively less or in progressively more refined and loving ways.